Nigeria in general. But Buhari should lead the way by example.
But the problem of insecurity in Nigeria facing President Muhammadu Buhari has started attracting the attention of the legislators. Some members of the House of Representatives have invited the president to come and answer questions on the security situation in Nigeria. President Muhammadu Buhari says he will honor the invitation, but no definite date has been fixed for the meeting with the lawmakers.
Experts believe that the ordinary Nigerian deserves peace and protection in Nigeria. Protection, they said, to freely go to his farm, harvest his crops so that he can feed his family. They said fear has now dominated the minds of many Nigerians in their homes, on their farms, and along highways where criminals kidnap and kill with impunity. Danjuma Abdullahi, Abuja.
It's being called the jobs report without a silver lining. United States corporate media is unable to put any positive spin on the number of new jobs produced in November, coming in at a whopping 60% under the initial prediction. It's the lowest monthly addition of jobs since April, coincides with a tripling in long-term unemployment since only September, and makes clear that temporary unemployment caused by coronavirus lockdowns have repeatedly led to permanent job losses.
The jobs report may be the final nail in the coffin of a so-called snapback economic recovery, which was so widely touted by the mainstream media last spring. A social recovery for the long-term unemployed and their dependents may prove to be just as difficult to achieve.
As seen following the 2008 recession in the U.S., the social effects of long-term unemployment include mental health problems, increased drug and alcohol addiction, an erosion of employable skills, and lasting family dysfunction. With stocks just having their best November ever, it's now clear that the U.S. has had a K-shaped recovery, with the rich and poor classes headed in opposite directions.
It's in shambles right now. There's no question about that. We're in the worst crisis for U.S. capitalism since the Great Depression. And this crisis isn't getting better. I mean, bills are compounding. Rent is compounding. It's not like things are getting better. For people who haven't been able to work, you know, they still have to pay. These numbers are still piling up. Medical bills are piling up. Utility bills are piling up.
The second wave of coronavirus has hit. Lockdowns and not more funding for health care is again America's solution. The new lockdowns are being called a gift to Amazon by small local business groups and will likely worsen the already bad unemployment situation, just as they did in spring. At the same time, pandemic stimulus unemployment benefits are scheduled to run out the day after Christmas for 15 million people. Data from MIT University estimated that the Paycheck Protection Program, from the first and only federal stimulus plan, spent nearly $250,000 to save each job. However, the maximum compensation to workers was capped at $100,000. The annual median personal income is just $33,000. It's caused many to wonder where the money for jobs really went. Rami Mazahari, Chicago.
Protests in Pakistan against the UAE was unthinkable until recently. However, now it is not so unusual after the UAE diplomatically recognized the apartheid regime of Israel. The public sentiments against several Arab rulers rose in Pakistan after the UAE and Bahrain started aligning their foreign policies with Israel and India. The normalization of Israel's ties with the UAE and Bahrain is now affecting Islamabad's long-standing relation with some Arab rulers, particularly of Saudi Arabia and UAE. Citing unspecified security threats and rise in coronavirus cases, the UAE now has banned visit and work visas to Pakistani citizens along with 13 other Muslim nations, most of whom have been angry with Abu Dhabi after it normalized ties with the Tel Aviv.
Countries like UAE receive such direct investment from investors from Israel and, for that matter, American Jewish community. Then obviously the UAE government and the investors from Israel, or for that matter, USA, would be cautious about how the local population, for that matter, how the immigrants might react and respond to direct presence of the Israeli, or for that matter, American Jewish investors in countries like UAE.
Without revealing their names, Prime Minister Imran Khan in a recent interview dropped a hint that Saudi Arabia and the UAE have been pressurizing Islamabad to normalize its ties with Israel. Islamabad has vowed not to give diplomatic recognition to Israel. Over 5 million Pakistanis work in UAE and Saudi Arabia, the two biggest remittance-generating Arab states.
Pakistan's economy is dependent on these remittances. Saudi Arabia and UAE have the tools in their hands to put pressure on Pakistan to recognize Israel. Pakistan's nuclear power has always been a problem for Israel. So therefore, Israel would love that Pakistan should give recognition to it. That's why UAE, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and other GCC countries want Pakistan to give recognition to Israel.
Political analysts say that Pakistan is running out of options, and in the current situation, it may inch closer to Turkey, Qatar, Iran, and more particularly to China to offset pressure from Saudi Arabia and UAE, which are strengthening their alliance with Israel, US, and India. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Due to the coronavirus pandemic, the European Defence Agency annual conference has taken place online. The event, which has just concluded, normally attracts protests as it brings together arms dealers, policymakers and politicians, while civil society representatives are banned. The usual rhetoric was peddled out at this year's conference, however.
We have to look together into the rise of China and also these issues. Speaking of Russia, they have developed, and they are developing as we speak, super advanced missile systems.
Campaigners say the EU and NATO create security threats to feed the arms industry, which is active in every one of the EU's 27 nations and has an annual turnover of more than 100 billion euro. The ongoing process to create an EU army means that even more taxpayers' money is being spent at a time when COVID-19 is pushing millions of citizens into poverty.
For the first time, we will invest 8 billion euros of EU budget money in cooperative defence R&D project.
Activists describe the EU's arms industry as immoral.
Exporting weapons to the Saudi-led coalition, which is waging war in Yemen. You have these huge amounts of money being made on the suffering of the Palestinian people.
Donald Trump's Make America Great Again slogan was mocked during the EU Defence Agency conference.
I very much hope that with Joe Biden we will have a partner in making, we have already started saying, making multilateralism great again.
The anti-war movement is suggesting those who believe we will have a more just world under Joe Biden's presidency should examine the history books.
The Obama-Biden team ordered 10 times more airstrikes using drones than the previous U.S. administration under George W. Bush. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The Islamic Republic of Iran currently has the highest blood donation rate in the Eastern Mediterranean region. And out of almost 10 million donation units in this region, over 2 million is by the Iranians. These days, a campaign is launched in Tehran to collect blood from athletes to encourage other people to donate their blood. The campaign is being promoted by Sports Society of Basij in collaboration with the country's blood transfusion organization.
We have organized this event to give the opportunity to athletes and other people to donate their blood to improve the level of blood banks in the country.
Famous sportsmen also took part to convince ordinary people to be part of the move as well.
I am here today to donate my blood because it's a must for everyone to help the patients. Our country needs our blood as the bank reservoirs are running low. I call on my fellow countrymen to come and help and save lives.
I want to be part of this campaign to do the least I can do for those who need blood. This can also improve the health in our country. As the body of athletes is strong, their blood is of a better quality. I ask all the athletes to show up and assist.
Studies showed that the plasma taken from the recovered people can be used in treating the coronavirus patients. While blood donation in many countries still depends on replacement or paid donors, Iran is the first country in the region that has enjoyed voluntary blood donation by 100% since 2007. Humayun Abedi, Tehran.
The humanitarian crisis in Yemen has been exacerbated by the incessant war and siege over the past 6 years. The executive director of the World Food Program, David Beasley, confirmed that the number of people facing the second highest level of food insecurity will increase from 3.6 million to 5 million in the first half of 2021.
There is indeed a humanitarian catastrophe, and if aid arrives, it goes to other places, and 70% of it goes to United Nations organizations to cover operational expenses. The other side must stop the blockade completely, because it affects Yemen in the medical, educational, and food sectors. So we think the focus should be on the root cause of the problem, which is the siege on Yemeni people.
Beasley called on the international community not to abandon the millions of families who are in severe need of aid. Millions of people are on the brink of a new famine as the UN's Yemen response faces historic shortfalls. $1.5 billion is what the donor governments contributed, while the UN says it needs $3.2 billion to avert the crisis.
Those who provide aid, such as the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, and America, have failed and did not abide by their pledges they made. They spent more than these sums to buy weapons, but they do not help Yemenis as they claim, which confirms the authenticity of the United Nations reports that famine is on the rise in Yemen.
The coronavirus pandemic, along with the funding crunch, has forced dozens of aid agencies and organizations working in Yemen to scale back their assistance. Some of them even had to give up their programs entirely, which has deteriorated the worst humanitarian crisis in the world, according to the UN. Famine can still be prevented if the international community wakes up to take serious action to save the lives of millions in Yemen, including women and the children. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The coordination Stop Global Security Law organized a new popular march for liberties and for justice all over France. The protesters want a total withdrawal of a law recently voted in the French Parliament that limits the possibility to film the police. They also denounce an authoritarian drift of the French government.
That authoritarian drift is evident. Look to the proposed laws. The existing legal framework in France is more than sufficient to control everything they want to. Why do they add new laws? It's only to limit more the freedom of expression and to sanction activists.
Trade unions say that the French government is taking advantage of the COVID-19 crisis to implement anti-social and austerity measures like the privatization of the health sector and the dismissal of workers.
They use the Terrorist Act and the health crisis as an alibi for restrictive measures. Since last week, the head of police has forbidden a demonstration in name of the COVID-19 crisis. This law has only one interest, to silence demonstrators.
Earlier this week, the Council of Ministers decided to close the main association against Islamophobia in France, the CCIF. French Interior Minister Darmanin qualified the CCIF as an enemy of the Republic and accused it of incitement to hatred and violence, discrimination, and of encouraging terrorism.
That's very surprising, because the CCIF has always profiled itself on the judicial scene and very little as political activists. The association limited itself to defend the legitimate rights of the Muslims. Now, in the context of an upsurge of terrorist attacks since 2015, the French government has entered in a phase of escalation of repressive measures that seriously limit the democratic liberties.
Amnesty International International declared that dissolving the CCIF is a violation of freedom of association. As for now, the French government remains inflexible towards the social protest. But tensions are rising in high government circles about the way the security issue in France is handled. The protesters promise not to give up until an important part of the law is cancelled. Chris Den Hond, Paris.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of a speech delivered on September 21, 2020, by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with participants in ceremonies throughout the country to honor the veterans of the Sacred Defense Era. The meeting was held on the occasion of 40th anniversary of the Sacred Defense.
The Sacred Defense literature is not a literary genre like other literary genres. It is like a bubbling spring where we can create all kinds of literature. We can use Sacred Defense literature to produce excellent historic, political, romantic, and familial texts and also to produce such materials for that literature itself. However, the important point is to produce text. We need to produce text. If good and eloquent texts are produced, then we can use them to write plays and to make movies. For example, I have heard that one of our committed poets has composed 10 ghazals, benefiting from the book written by our eloquent martyr, When the Moonlight Was Missing. Very well. If committed poets enter the arena, they can compose tens of collections by utilizing Sacred Defense materials. Poetry is a great art. The same is true of movies and the cinema. We should produce cinematic works and the like. This is being done in the world as well.
Your light and love, all I see. Nothing or I'd ever want to need, my Lord. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
In other countries in the world, too, perhaps the best cinematic works are based on excellent writings and texts. They use the outstanding and excellent novels that have been written before. We should do the same. We should produce these outstanding texts, and we should make movies and plays and then put them on the stage. So, it is an important task. I have heard that inside the country, they put on the stage the works of foreign writers such as Victor Hugo and Charles Dickens. Very well. We should also do something to make others in other countries, first in our country and then in other countries, put our writings and texts on the stage and then produce movies out of them. In other words, we should focus our efforts on producing outstanding writings. Another point is about commemoration ceremonies. Commemoration ceremonies are an important discussion and a great task as they help bridge the gap between generations. They help young generations become familiar with the Sacred Defense. This will be effective in building personalities like Shahid Hojaji or other dear martyrs of defending the holy shrines. Of course, This is also another blessing and auspicious outcome of the sacred defense era.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of Halim, please.
Kitty, good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
The Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon thee. By Muhammad, the chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but thy generosity, and none supports but thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey thee. Worship by which I may deserve thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that thou makest me secure in the places of fear through thy security. And placest me in thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
The debate.
Hello and a warm welcome to The Debate. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. A joint statement by EU and UK says that following intensive work, the two sides can now announce their agreement in principle on all issues with regard to the protocol on the two islands. After lots of 10 months, differences still remain on governance, fisheries, and standards. The UK is speaking of removing some controversial clauses from the internal market bill, while the EU has negated any undue sacrifices to secure a trade deal with Britain. Are the two sides going to remove the remaining obstacles to a deal on future trade ties within the limited time left? Stay with us for a debate on that issue. Let's first go to our London bureau, Saeed Pourreza is there. Saeed, tell us about the London side of this prolonged, you know, process of discussions and talks.
The agreement today will be removing the controversial clauses out of the internal markets bill. Caused uproar not only in European capitals but also in the U.S. It is being received as welcome news, but is it being treated as a breakthrough in the trade talks? Probably not. The honest answer to where these negotiations stand, the over trade, a trade deal between the U.K. and the EU, is that really, no one knows which way these negotiations are going to go. Both sides have painted a gloomy picture of it all. Number 10 saying today that the chances of a deal are not very good. As a matter of fact, most recently, the British Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, said, and I quote, "You have to be optimistic. You have to believe in the power of sweet reason to get this thing over the line. But it's looking very, very difficult at the moment. The key thing," he said, "is that whatever happens on January 1st, that's the day after the December 31st deadline, things are going to change and people ought to get ready for that change." On the European side, the chief negotiator, Michel Barnier, who has been very optimistic all along and has kept things smooth, has been quoted as saying today in a meeting with heads of states that the chances of reaching an agreement with the UK are now very slim. So as you can see, very gloomy on both sides, both parties to these negotiations. Realistically, the only people who know the answer to where things are going, what will happen next, are two people: the EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen and the UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who will be meeting at some point this week. And of course, this comes after a lengthy phone call between the two of them. I think it was yesterday or the day before, that really didn't break the impasse in the negotiations. As you said earlier, what we need to look at again is what's happening on the edges of these negotiations. Perhaps look at the internal politics in the UK, the agreement today between the Cabinet Office Minister Michael Gove and his European counterparts vis-a-vis the internal market bill. Perhaps that might send a signal that the UK is willing to compromise, because so far the two sides have been very recalcitrant, if you will, in their positions. The UK not really budging over fisheries and those two other issues, such as the level playing field or state subsidies to businesses, as well as the issue of governance. Those three stumbling blocks still remain in the way of a trade talk. So the UK position seems to be just the same as the EU's. Both sides seem to want a deal, but at the same time, they're not really ready to make any compromises on their positions. And as I say, both sides saying that the chances of a deal don't look very, very good at this point.
Okay, appreciate that, Psaid Purozan, London Bureau. Now, joining me in this debate first will be Director of the Seven Investment Management, Justin Urquhart. Stewart is joining us out of London. Good to have you with us, sir. UK Cabinet Office.
Thank you.
UK Cabinet Office Minister Michael Gove has expressed delight over reaching an agreement on post-Brexit arrangements for the Irish border. Is this a breakthrough that could facilitate the trade deal eventually?
Your commentator from London was absolutely right. No, it wasn't really a breakthrough. Frankly, this was almost a rather strange, well, it was a very strange action taken by the government previously on this. And in many ways, it was almost set up to try and actually almost annoy the EU in their negotiations, and then to be able to give away on it later in time, to be able to say, well, actually, we've now given something back to you, it's a negotiating ploy. Actually, I don't think that really worked. It just served only to annoy absolutely everybody, and especially the Irish, and also, of course, the Americans as well. And this came up during the presidential election. So I'm afraid, as your commentator said, we're still waiting to see whether there's going to be a final agreement. But as often with European affairs, it's often right at the last minute that something may well be pulled out of the bag.
Well, Justin, the Johnson administration has announced that it will remove law-breaking clauses from the internal market bill. That's been a source of concern for the EU. Would that go through Westminster, you think?
Yes, it would go through. That would actually be approved, because there was a lot of anger, actually, because of it was seen as really the United Kingdom going against international law, being seen to breach an international agreement that it had with the EU. And that would be very bad in terms of reputation. Obviously, that sort of reputation when you're doing international deals, well, as having people going back on their word, no, not their word, on a signed treaty, I'm afraid would be seen as a very bad precedent indeed. And frankly, I think an awful lot of the politicians were seriously embarrassed. This is not the sort of thing you would expect from the United Kingdom government.
Mm-hmm. Okay, also joining us on this debate show will be journalist and commentator on international affairs, James Tweedy, out of Plymouth. Good to have you with us, James. Let's have your opinion on this agreement that Michael Gove talked about, and if you think that this could kind of help facilitate the future trade relations and clinching a deal on that front.
Well, what this seems to do is tidy up the withdrawal agreement that was agreed back in 2019, more than a year ago, about a year ago. And it deals with certain disputes that have arisen around Northern Ireland and, you know, the provisions on Northern Ireland. And so that seems to tidy that up, and that you know, at the very least says that the withdrawal agreement, the original withdrawal agreement, will be maintained. Neither side is going to break it, and neither side is going to pull out of it because the other side has broken some of the provisions of it. So, okay, that's one thing. It doesn't necessarily mean there's going to be a deal, because everything I'm reading about this right now says that the EU is still asking for the same things it was 6 months or a year ago, that Britain must continue to abide by rules that it makes, including new rules that it makes after, you know, we've already left the EU, but from now on, and that European fishermen should have almost the same level of access to British fishing waters for a very long period of time, at least 10 years. So that's not going to fly necessarily unless the British government decides to cave in on those issues, which everything they're saying is that they're not going to do that. So, okay, they've said many times they're not going to do that. If they do, then it discredits them. So, yes, it's hard to see where this is going to go. I mean, there are sources who say that actually Michel Barnier is the one who's responsible for this, along with the French government. He was self-isolating for a few days after one of his team tested positive for COVID-19. He couldn't really play much part in the negotiations, even virtually. Ursula von der Leyen, the president of the EU Commission, took over and started to make some concessions, because I think what the Germans, she's German, right? What the Germans want is they want to be able to sell motor cars and other heavy industrial goods in Britain without tariffs. What the French want, well, okay, they make a lot of cars and things too that they export to us, but you know, the kind of lobby of the farmers and the fishermen there is politically more powerful perhaps, and they want to maintain this kind of, you know, they want to keep having that access to our fisheries.
Okay, back to London. Justin, Boris Johnson hopes, I'm quoting him, the power of sweet reason will allow the UK and EU to reach a post-Brexit trade deal this week. Are you optimistic this is going to happen?
Well, I was optimistic the past few days, but maybe more pessimistic. Well, put it this way, it would be incredibly stupid for the British government not to have a deal. Brexit in its own right is already going to make the country, the economy, smaller anyway over the next few years. And by not having a trade deal, that's going to make it even worse. Now, it's going to actually impact not just on confidence within the United Kingdom itself, but also inward investment confidence. And, of course, one of the key areas that has been ignored on this, really, has been the Japanese car plants, where they assemble Japanese cars in the United Kingdom. Mm-hmm. The United Kingdom was very willing to accept these to be developed. And the deal, particularly with Nissan, was really they saw Britain, the United Kingdom, as a gateway to Europe, not as a destination. And so therefore, when the threat of Brexit came up, Nissan made it abundantly clear that unless we have exactly the same position we're in now, then the next round of investment in the next series of cars will be going to Barcelona in Spain and not to Sunderland in Northern England. So it remains to be seen that if they don't get that, we don't get that deal coming through, whether the Japanese follow through on that. And although they have said they would invest in Sunderland, actually, we also know that there's a backup. They may well reverse that decision. So for Boris Johnson, despite his own political problems with inside his party, with a lot of Brexiteers in there, actually, economically, it will be very difficult and very dangerous for this economy, especially with regard to the key elements of our financial areas, which is actually the City of London and financial services, which earns a huge amount of money for the UK economy. Whereas, of course, actually fishing, which is very emotional to many people, with people going out and actually risking their lives fishing and such like, but economically is almost irrelevant to the British economy. And so, therefore, they must get a deal. And frankly, the fishermen should not be getting in the way of it.
Mm-hmm. Now, James, Michel Barnier has stressed on his Twitter page that, quote, access to our market comes with conditions. What conditions is he alluding to?
Well, he's talking about this regulatory alignment where we have to follow the same rules as the EU that they set, but we don't have a say in, and that we shouldn't, and part of some of those rules include that we are not allowed to give any kind of state aid to industry, you know, which could be defined, by a judge. So it could be, you know, almost anything. It could be like the government giving contracts to one company and not another, perhaps. But, you know, certainly it would prevent, you know, it did not prevent the great banking bailout during the credit crunch. They didn't make any objections to that. But it has in the past prevented the British government from saving steel makers in this country, which is quite an important industry, or it used to be. It still is significant in this country. So then we have Bombardier, there's a company which is based in Canada but has operations in Northern Ireland. That has been accused of, the EU has been accused of giving state aid to that, to Bombardier by the US. And then the EU has also accused the US of giving state aid to Boeing, you see. So now Bombardier is going to be our responsibility. They make passenger jets. So if we keep, subsidizing them to produce those jets in Northern Ireland, which has got quite a depressed economy, then maybe the EU will say, no, that's not good, can't do that. So this kind of thing. So actually any kind of what you might call a progressive social democratic policy is actually kind of banned by the EU. Lots of those kind of policies are banned by the EU because the government can't intervene in the economy, you see. So these are the problems. I mean, another thing I'm going to say is that, he says, you can't have access to your market unless you follow our rules. Well, okay, the people who voted to leave never actually felt any great benefit from the EU, and actually they felt that they've actually lost things, like many people lost their jobs, because we used to have a much larger car making industry in this country, and after we joined the EU, a lot of it was shipped to Eastern Europe. The factories moved to Eastern Europe, production of companies like Ford, which was exclusively in Britain and the east of London, moved to Eastern Europe. So, we've lost out because of free trade. So actually, losing free trade with Europe isn't such a bad thing. We trade more with the rest of the world than we do with the EU now, and trade with the rest of the world is growing 10 times faster than trade with the EU. It has been for the last decade. So, the trends are that Europe is not so important. I say Europe, I mean, the European Union, which doesn't include the two most important countries in Europe, which are Russia and the UK, is not that important to us anymore, and is becoming less and less important, and the rest of the world is more important.
Now, Justin, the two sides still disagree on issues like fishing rights, business competition rules, and the manner of their implementation. Do you know of any solutions to those issues?
Yes, the fishing rights could actually be put to one side and be dealt with separately, because previously this was already managed by way of licenses which had been issued to various countries and to the fishing industry in those countries. And in fact, the United Kingdom's fishing industry has actually sold their licenses. So this is an issue which has already been dealt with separately and, frankly, is getting in the way of this particular element. And the problem is it's become a very emotional subject, which, of course, the media has picked up on. And, of course, it's always very emotional with sailors going out and catching these fish. But as I said before, it's actually not actually that important. In terms of subsidies overall, it's fascinating because, of course, one government's investment is another country's subsidy. Europe's been having subsidies or investments for years doing this. So, it's a matter of interpretation. Now, what the EU wants to make sure is there isn't going to be any unfair bias in terms of supporting industries, and I suppose that's only going to be to be expected. But Britain does need to be part of the trading unit. As James was just saying, trade elsewhere around the world has been growing, but Britain's largest trading partner in the world is the EU, the largest trading bloc in the world, and in terms of actually the value to us of that, it's very important. But also, don't underestimate the amount of value that actually the UK is to certainly countries like Germany and the exports of their cars coming through. But really one of the key elements has been some of the infrastructure which is so vital in Europe, certainly in terms of scientific infrastructure, investment infrastructure and things like that, which Britain will now be missing out on and has already been losing out in terms of some of the jobs and future investment. So any particular deal wouldn't necessarily reverse any of that process, but it still makes sure that the United Kingdom has access to the free market. If you don't have access to that, you immediately start seeing tariff rises, and the operational structure of moving elements without barriers across the not just the English Channel, but also across the Irish borders as well, okay. will cause operational difficulties. Mm-hmm. And that's an unnecessary cost, which the United Kingdom does not need.
Okay. Now, James, we have 1 minute only, and this is the last question. Johnson has spoken of difficult talks, but promised there are great options ahead of his country on any view. What is he talking about?
Well, he's being optimistic. He's saying that Britain will, as he's said for years now, that Britain will thrive when it's outside the EU. It will, you know, it has opportunities. Certainly, Britain can, as being independent of the EU, can sign trade deals with other countries, which it already has done, and it doesn't have to wait for the EU's approval on that. Staying within the EU customs union would have prevented us from doing that, for instance. So, okay, there's that. And I suppose he is still, you know, he's still saying he's optimistic of making a deal, even though essentially all progress has been set back to, you know, to square one. But there it is. What else can I say? I'd just like to answer something that Mr. Stewart said. You know, I should stress that Britain has far higher standards than most European countries when it comes to things like labor standards, food standards, consumer standards, health standards.
Okay.
We're one of the countries with the highest minimum wage. That's why British manufacturing jobs have been offshored into Eastern Europe, for instance.
Okay, we're out of time. Sorry, I got to jump in. That's all the time we have.
Okay, thanks very much.
Okay, let me thank our guests. We have Director of Seven Investment Management, Justin Urquhart-Stewart, to join us from London, and journalist and commentator on international affairs, James Tootie, out of Plymouth.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Scientists have identified an old piece of the Pacific Ocean, the ancient remains of its long-ago seabed, extending hundreds of miles underneath China as it is pulled downward into Earth's mantle transition zone. This rocky slab that used to line the bottom of the Pacific is a relic of the oceanic lithosphere, the outermost layer of Earth's surface, composed of the crust and the solid outermost parts of the upper mantle. The lithosphere isn't always destined to enjoy the views up top, however. The upper surface layer is composed of several fragmented tectonic plates, which slowly move and shift around at the surface, occasionally running into each other. What you just heard were words selected from a scientific article penned by Peter Dockrill under the heading, Ancient Fragment of the Pacific Ocean Found Buried 400 Miles Below China. Stay with us for more on this topic. Scientists have identified an old piece of the Pacific Ocean, the ancient remains of its long-ago seabed, extending hundreds of miles underneath China, as it is pulled downward into Earth's mantle transition zone. This rocky slab that used to line the bottom of the Pacific is a relic of the oceanic lithosphere, the outermost layer of Earth's surface, composed of the crust and the solid outermost parts of the upper mantle. The lithosphere isn't always destined to enjoy the views up top, however. The upper surface layer is composed of several fragmented tectonic plates, which slowly move and shift around at the surface, occasionally running into each other. During these collisions, a geological process called subduction can occur, where one plate gets forced under the other at subduction zones and ends up being driven ever deeper into the planet. In a new study, scientists have now witnessed this epic phenomenon taking place at greater depths than ever before observed. Prior to this, scientists had recorded subducting slabs, probing the boundaries at depths of about 200 kilometers. Now, thanks to a giant network of over 300 seismic stations spread around northeastern China, researchers were able to see the event at a much lower point, imaging parts of the tectonic plate that used to lie under the Pacific Ocean being pushed into the mantle's mid-level transition zone at depths ranging between 410 to 660 kilometers below Earth's surface. To interpret the sinking slab, the team identified two seismic velocity discontinuities, regions far underground where seismic waves encounter anomalies. In this case, two anomalies were encountered, which the team says related to both the top and bottom sides of the plunging plate. Based on detailed seismological analysis, the upper discontinuity was interpreted to be the Moho discontinuity of the subducted slab, says geophysicist Qi Fu Chen from the Chinese Academy of Sciences. The lower discontinuity is likely caused by partial melting of the sub-slab asthenosphere under hydrous conditions in seaward portion of the slab. While the plate subduction can be seen in process below China, the subduction zone itself lies far to the east, the slab being angled at a relatively shallow 25-degree angle downwards. Japan is located about where the Pacific plate reaches around 100-kilometer depth, says seismologist Frangin Niu. Thanks to the new imaging, scientists are getting a better idea of what happens to a subducted slab when it reaches this part of the transition zone, including how deformed it gets and how much water content it loses from its oceanic crust. A lot of studies suggest that the slab actually deforms a lot in the mantle transition zone, that it becomes soft, so it's easy deformed, Neo says. We are still debating whether this water is totally released in that depth. there is increasing evidence that a portion of the water stays inside the plate to go much, much deeper.
Of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is